This episode of AVXL was recorded on November 23rd, 2016. We're going to talk Extreme, Dolby Atmos, DTS, Class T amps, dealing with aging AVRs, Black Friday, I'll probably mention headphones, and so much more.
Testing, 1, 2, 3. All right, I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
Welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home theater gear and content. No matter what your budget is, we love audio, we love video, we love music, headphones, mayhem. Maybe not so much the mayhem.
Mayhem is good.
I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, and I'm Robert Herron.
And, man, good week at my house this week.
Nice. Yes. It's the holiday, at least the Thanksgiving season here in the Bay Area. So anytime those holidays roll around, I get my 1 or 2 day break of traffic in the Bay Area, so you can drive like a normal person, or actually commute without traffic for, you know.
So it just feels less Mad Max for a couple of days.
It's the way it should be.
Christmas Eve, 2 a.m., great time to drive in the Bay Area.
Oh, it's so nice today, just today.
Just today. Well, that was also because you weren't up at 5:15 this morning when there was a...
I was watching the rain and listening to traffic reports.
Aww.
I had the animals in bed with me.
Meditative.
It's very nice.
This technically is a show about 4K, UHD, HDTV, audio, headphones. So I was saying, it's a good week in my house.
What excites your senses?
The audio situation in my living room is now, even by my standards, completely out of control. Because I've got...
Bad?
No, awesome, right?
Okay.
Because I've got the T305, the beautiful KEFs I've got for my surround sound system.
Oh, nice.
And my wife put a couple of the Sonos speakers we use in the living room. Because she loves Sonos. And then I finally, bought out of my own pocket the ELAC Unified B5 speakers, the ones I saw originally back at CES.
Very
neat. Heard them again at Rocky Mountain Audio Fest. I didn't see them. I heard them and saw them at CES. $500 a pair. Can't beat them for the money. It's an incredible set of bookshelf speakers. And I've got those set up. There was this funny moment where my wife, I played one of my wife's favorite songs through them. She's like, these sound amazing. And then like a day and a half later, she's like, are those loaners or did you buy those? I bought those. Okay, I'll clear off space on the bookshelves so you can push them up against the wall on the bookshelves. And I'm like, honey, they have rear ports. We can't shove the rear ported speakers up against the wall.
I think your methodology for incorporating new gear into the household is working out quite well. The key, apparently, is pleasing the significant other.
The spousal acceptance factor is always
you got to wow them. Are they a visual person? Are they an audio person more so?
Well,
focus on that. And then you can sneak in all the tech you need and want and desire.
You know, a little bit here, a little bit there. But, you know, it's funny because bookshelf speakers, they need to be elevated. You need to have them off the wall.
Yeah,
you know, right. You need like, you know, 1 or 2 feet. There's probably a guidelines from the person who designed your speaker, but
it helps just not to slap them on top of a table in the middle of it and leave them there.
No. You know, speaker stands, I'm going to give a shout out to Brent Butterworth for the heads up on Pangea Audio's LS200, which used to be on Amazon and audioadvisor.com, but I don't know if they've phased them out or if they're just out of the supply.
What is that product you just mentioned?
That's a speaker stand.
Oh, okay.
They had like 24, 28, whatever size version of them. You know, they were like $80 a pair, which is pretty reasonable for what's probably like, you know, $4 worth of mild steel and some paint.
If they last, you know.
So far, they're holding up pretty well.
That's what counts.
I was thinking about welding some, but I'm like, I need them. I don't need a welding project. I need speaker stands.
Yeah. Time. Time is precious, people.
Oh, my goodness. Well, they still have the LS300s for sale all over the place. Those are about $120, but that's $40 more than what I spent for mine. But I was laughing because, you know, you immediately mentioned Blue Tack to stick the speakers to the speaker stands.
Somebody introduced me to that stuff a long time ago, and it was like every now and then I'll come across somebody who's just got a speaker on top of a stand, but it's not connected in any way.
Right.
It's literally just sitting there. And great if you are the only person in that room and you know never to touch those things, but that little bit of blue stickiness, that little tacky, it's removable and non-marring and all that other good stuff about it, and it's better than duct taping a speaker to a stand. But that stuff can be handy, and it's good for just for basic... Keep it pointed where I had it, and don't if
like
it's
little centimeter-sized balls or
it comes in like sticks of gum style stuff, and you just, you know, squeeze a little off and knead it up like dough, stick it where you need it, and then plop the speaker right on there, and it does a pretty good job of holding
you
things
to You have
surfaces.
To be really careful to, you know, get four balls of the same size so you don't end up with a tilted speaker.
I've gone so far as to actually weigh them out on my little digital scale. Just
the thing about Robert, he's actually more OCD
cookies,
than I am. Which
or
is
I'm playing with Blue Tack. The kitchen scale comes in handy for many things.
All ingredients in baking should be weighed. Doing it by volume is wrong.
If you want it to taste good. I would agree with that statement.
Do you believe in spikes, spike stands, stand spikes for speakers? I mean, they work for leveling.
Yeah, well, I mean, feet to level something is one thing, but...
I mean the ones where they come in the box. Like these Pangea speaker and had full on, like, they're going to tear apart the floor
in
my house.
An exceptionally spikes. Very nice client's home. Uh-huh. And man, I mean, just in terms of the gear they had.
Right.
Just, and all of the speakers were on serious metal spikes onto metal pads so it wouldn't, you know, dig right into the hardwood floor. But is there a performance advantage to those spikes?
I've heard.
I mean, in terms of keeping it right where you put it, sure, it's spiked to the ground.
Right.
But is there a vibration reduction or
so
an isolation thing going on there? That I don't know anything
about.
There's
a pretty good article up on Audioholics.
They look cool.
They look cool. They are
very medieval.
Well, I think those are definitely one of those things where, you know, it's become a checkbox style feature. Because I was looking at...
Even the least expensive speaker stands I own came with both sets where you could either have flat feet on them for, you know, regular surfaces or... spiked into your carpet or whatever or what however you're dealing with it.
But. Yeah, there's a Audioholics article where they talk about he basically believes the author of the article believes that the spikes going through a carpet and into a wood floor improve the sound quality of the speakers. He's like, but I haven't measurement and it may be completely inside of my head. I noticed in the manual for the Unify because the tower speakers include spikes, they just mention them as being for, you know, all they just say is like, you know, they just mention leveling the speaker, and the spikes are there to make the speaker wider and less prone to tip over.
That has been the case, and I typically have only used them on carpet, except for, like I said, that last home I was in where they actually had special pucks that looked like it came with the speaker
I'm sure
spikes.
They did.
For placing it on surfaces you didn't want to actually jam a spike into. So,
you know,
is there performance improvement? I could think for isolation of components, especially if you have maybe a turntable or something that you need isolated. But the folks I see with high-end turntables usually have them on separate stands, completely isolated from the rest of their gear anyway.
Well, the article, the Audioholics article, Speaker Spikes and Cones, what's the point? They actually...
bless those folks at Audioholics, man.
Yeah, it's
they
good stuff.
They do a lot of good work.
Well, you know, one of the things he found is there was, you know, it was way back 2002, Keith Howard in Hi-Fi News did an article where he measured the vibrations of the difference between using an accelerometer to measure, quote, the levels of vibration in various objects. And on rubber feet, he basically measured rubber feet versus spikes. And on the cones or the spikes, the level of vibration, quote, the level of vibration of the stand was over 100 times greater than if the cones were replaced with small rubbery feet.
That
so
totally
if the
makes
spikes
sense.
Or the cones are supposed to isolate you from vibration, that's not the way physics works.
No.
Because if physics worked that way, we would pack valuable small objects in metal spikes instead of inside of sorbethane, you know?
Then I'm thinking it's more for just it simply staying put.
Yeah.
More so than anything. Because that does make total sense. Yeah, you don't want a hard thing. Some of the most expensive equipment I've ever worked on was CNC machines for milling and things like that. We had a brand, couple of them delivered, and they were over 100 grand each. We did not put these on metal spikes to... fix them to the floor. They actually had these special pads, actually, because everything weighed so much. It was all ridiculous. But yeah, we were using some type of high-end rubber isolation pads on everything. So yeah, now that I think about this a little more.
Well, sorbethane, sorbethane is interesting. It's a material that's fascinated me since I was in high school, which was slightly after rock became dirt.
Oh, please.
Well, you know, there's moments. But sorbethane is really fascinating because it is it's a viscoelastic material. It's not exactly solid and it's not exactly liquid. But it essentially it essentially turns, I want to say it turns impact or shock into heat, although I don't think that's actually correct. But okay. I just remember having these sorbethane knee pads on at wrestling and banging myself on a going off the mat onto the concrete in a way that probably would have shattered my kneecap or at least would have left it bruised, and been like, this science is amazing.
I love it.
So now I'm looking at actual sheets of sorbethane, and you can pick up a 12, like a 1/8 inch, 12 by 12 inch sorbethane sheet for like $26. So maybe I should sorbethane my speakers to the floor.
You know, because the more, as I sit here and continue to think about it, I'm definitely reading that Audioholics article too, just about the spike designs. But another thing too, if you live in an apartment complex where you have people above or below you,
right,
the last thing you want to do to be a great neighbor is to spike your speakers to the floor where you're transmitting all the sound, apparently 100x the vibrations through a connection, that interface, compared to doing something like padded or something to truly isolate it. Yeah. Man. Okay. Anyway, spikes are spikes. They look cool, but the isolation thing, now I'm questioning everything. I don't think it isolates anything, to be honest with you. I think it's made to tie it into your structure.
I can totally see where somebody...
Where you want to feel more.
It's, you know, somebody out there must know, like, you know, who did the first spike on it. I'm sure it came out of, you know,
that's hilarious,
the 1950s equivalent of DIY audio. But the, you know, I'll buy into the idea that they originally, because maybe their speakers were moving and they wanted to keep their speakers from, you know, shimmying their way down the hallway.
A little vibration.
Oh, my goodness.
Spike them in. Speaking of speakers, I was glancing through Dolby Atmos setups or multi-channel speaker setups, and then what kind of gear you would need. This could also apply to something like DTS:X or RU3D, any of those 3D audio formats that are out now that use more object-based positional audio rather than just saying, oh, you have discrete number of speakers, and here's the format we're dealing with. Anyway, I was looking at what amps and hardware you would need to drive a complete system, say, and typically you're talking 5.1 or 7.1 standard speaker setups, or 7.2, you know, if you have one or two subs, that's right. Kind of beside the point. But to get the full four speakers up into the ceiling, and then what hardware would be required? And one of the things that just kind of popped out at me looking at the hardware that's out there right now is when it comes to amplifiers, an AVR, so to speak, to do that full 7-channel with the four ceiling speakers, that's 11 channels of amplification. And the amps I'm seeing out there that are 11 channel amps are in the highest of rarefied pricing in terms of how much you're looking to spend.
Really?
And granted, and I'm looking at just some of the bigger name brands out there too. You can get into some of the custom, not custom, but some of the very high end electronic shops too that make beautiful, beautiful amps. Anyway, getting back to that, if you wanted one amp to basically drive all 11 speakers in that full setup for, say, a Dolby Atmos, you're looking at like $2,200
right,
for a typical 11-channel amp.
Yeah, this is not for two-channel speakers that sit on top of your existing speakers for your $400 amp. You're going the whole.
You
want to
do it all
with
one
Atmos box.
Okay. Yeah, if you want to do all, if you want that full thing with. Specifically, the four ceiling channels in particular, you're going to need not only an AVR to decode it to the number of speakers needed, but then it requires amplifying. And the difference I'm seeing between the highest end AVRs that do at least 11 channel amplification versus the ones that step back and say provide 11 channel output, yet only say 9 channels of amplification,
right,
several hundred dollars in price difference, just adding that it seems going from like 9.2 to 11.2. So, and if you do go with one of these, you know, more value-oriented AVRs, and you are looking to do those four channels in the ceiling plus the seven others, you're basically talking, you know, a setup that, well, either you're going with a more affordable amp than adding another amp in order to drive those last two speakers, or you're just getting rid of two of the ceiling channels and, you know, sacrificing that way. But it's a lot of money, I'm realizing, if you really want to do the full Dolby Atmos effect, using ceiling speakers and standing floor speakers, that kind of setup. And it was just a reminder that it looks great on paper. I'm sure it sounds amazing, but if you really want to do it full bore, you're talking some very expensive hardware out there just to do that the amplification side of it.
Right.
I was more than, and then suddenly that took me to what would I need to do to really max out the format?
Mm-hmm.
And apparently for Dolby and their Atmos format, they could technically support, and they even claim this, up to 24 speakers on the floor and 10 overhead. And okay, that goes, you know, we're talking 34 speakers total.
Right.
How would you deal with something like that? And that's where I started looking at then just the decoders, not amplifiers, right. What they call preprocessors in a sense. And there are some amazing products out there as well. And then you start getting into the very expensive companies that make this custom gear. I hate saying custom, but it's not the popular mass produced stuff.
Right.
At a relatively reasonable price. We're talking amps that can go up to, or decoders that can, you know, five figures and then some. So, but when that jumped out at me, it's like, okay, if I did want all of the channels of decoding for these 3D audio formats, Trinov has their Altitude 32, which I'll just point out, and they don't even list a price for it, but it provides 32 channels of audio decoding, and then you could just set up whatever amplifiers you want from that point. So I'm suddenly thinking I've got some uses for your monoblocks in addition to other things, but that's a challenge. If you really want that, going beyond 5.1 and getting into those 3D audio formats, you can spend a lot of money. And I'm trying to think of like the most cost-effective ways of doing it. And it's still a lot of money, no matter how you look at it. So keep that in mind if you're out there shopping for these amplifiers and you're looking to do those four channels in the ceiling. Just be aware. Add up the number of speakers you have and then make sure that amp you're buying or amps is going to properly do it. And it was the decoding side of it. It's like, okay, what if I want 20 speakers in this room? It's like, what amp am I buying then that's going to decode all of that? It's like, it isn't from most of your standard shops, like your Sonys and your Pioneers and things like that. You're looking at some of the more high-end manufacturers who are dealing with that kind of stuff, or pro gear at that point. So anyway, just one of those observations. And it gave me a chance to drool over some very nice AVRs. I was just like, oh, updating my prices and checking things out. And
oh, man.
But it suddenly makes me go, I really want that 11-channel amp over a 9-channel amp.
You're going to need a bigger living room.
or like as long as it has the outputs, too. Because that was one thing. You could save $600-$700 just by going with that 9.2 amp that still provided the full 11-channel output, although two of those being unamplified. So anyway.
Yeah.
It was just an observation, and it makes me want more speakers. So
I'm going to stick to my 5.1 system.
I'm rolling that in the living room right now, and it looks and sounds great.
Oh, man, the Denon AVR S720W, which is like the entry-level choice, wire cutter pick. It's down to $349. And that one will support, that does 5.1.2. That does stereo Atmos. And I got to say, having heard like stereo versus four speaker Atmos at Dolby Labs.
So you're not even able to do the four channel ceiling with that.
No, but I think the four sound, unless you have a particularly big, you know what I mean? Like if you have a home theater in the sense of like this room, which I can fit 15 people in their captain's chairs, that I'm looking at your 32 speaker system and you know, selling
more
one of the Ferraris to pay for it with the installation and the speakers. But if you are like, you know, I sit on a couch and I watch movies, I think if you want to experience Atmos, you know, getting a couple of inexpensive, you know, Pioneer Atmos upfiring speakers and a, you know, an AVR S720W, this the two speaker Atmos can, you know, in my experience, has sounded really good. Admittedly, in that particular environment, I was also
affordable.
Surrounded by, you know, I'm pretty sure the set of focal speakers in that room at Dolby Labs was worth about as much as my house. I could be wrong. But
I also too would just like to see like a dumb box that would just do the decoding and provide preamp outs.
I think part of it,
and make that stupid cheap, and let me then add whatever amplifiers I want to deal with however many number of speakers I want, and maybe make it something like a 10-channel preamp, and then you could stack a couple of those or three of them, you know. And you know, I see opportunities here for helping get this kind of audio technology into more people's hands. But when you're talking the speaker install itself,
right,
plus a $2,300 to $2,500 amp or more, you can spend all you want on these things, or at least a receiver to do the decoding, and then an additional amp if you need it. But
right.
It's I want it, but at the same time, I see the issue of, you know, throwing down a lot of money on a box that you hope you don't have to replace in the near future. So for any particular reason. And that's the other thing too, I would like to see more of these AVR folks do. It's like, you think about amplification technology right. in general for an AVR, that really doesn't change a whole hell of a lot. Sure, there's always new ways of creating the amplified signals,
right.
be it digital or new whatever, but the core decoding technology within these things should be more firmware upgradable. They really need something like almost a Raspberry Pi in these AVRs.
It's funny because I'm looking at Emotiva's website. And a lot of people aren't familiar with Emotiva. They are a boutique audio shop. They have a fantastic reputation, especially in the stereo listening community. You know, and it's like, you know, they're doing stuff, but they do amplifiers. They do some professional, you know, near field monitors, a turntable. Their DACs are pretty nice. They have a pretty good deal right now for $99 on the Little Ego, which supports 32-bit, 384K audio if you're into that kind of thing. They have some fantastic entry-level amplifiers, and they've, like the A100 that they just started. They basically just started selling this again, you know, for $195. It's on sale right now. It's a pretty fantastic little amplifier, and they're basically all about audio quality. But they do a thing with their preamplifier. They do. Sorry, I like clicked on the wrong page, and suddenly I was somewhere. you know, they basically made their XMC-1, which is a $2,000 7.2 channel AV preamp. But they, you know, set it up so that their idea is to make it modular so that you can add in additional features over time. You know, we've seen, you know, Denon and Marantz, which are basically the same company. We've seen a lot of people do that in software, but it's a challenge because the other thing you have to do is you actually have to finish the upgrade or the update and make it actually work.
Yeah.
Which is non-trivial. In any case.
Crazy.
Crazy.
Gotta love it, though.
Oh, my goodness. Brian Fober. Excuse me, Frober. Actually, before we get to Brian's question, I'll remind everybody that we want your viewer questions. Ask at avxl.com or tweet at Robert Heron or at Patrick Norton or at avxl. Email is a really good place to send them. Tell us what you're curious about. Tell us what you want us to hear talk more about. And if you enjoy the show, we'd really appreciate it if you went to patreon.com/avxl and joined our Patreon for a, you know, a dollar or two a month. You can help pay for our bandwidth and keep us doing this show. And in exchange, we got some, we'll post you on the wall. We've got the opportunity to hang out with Robert and I. And we actually have our second hangout this month is November 26th, the day after Black Friday at 4 p.m. So if you do actually go out to battle your way through the mall on Friday, you can drink yourself into submission, wake up late, eat your eggs, and then join us at 4 o'clock to talk about whatever you guys want to talk about. And ladies.
Excellent. 4 p.m. Pacific.
Oh, my goodness. So, Brian.
West Coast.
A.K.A. at NecrosAss, AVXL, at Patrick Norton. Can you recommend a Class T speaker amp with a small footprint like the FIO A1 or Dayton DTA-120, $200 or less? So, Class T amps are essentially a variation of a Class D or a switching amplifier that was invented by a company called TriPath many, many years ago. Very, very inexpensive amplifier, and the sound quality is pretty fantastic. I'm a big fan of the Lapi LP2020A, which you can still buy at Parts Express for like $28,
$29. Yeah, I love that website.
And then there's the Lepy, L-E-P-Y, which is essentially a clone or the same company or who knows what the deal is. But essentially the same thing, which is on Amazon for $24. And, you know, these are the thing about a lot of the TriPath amplifiers is their ratings are generous. You know, they claim
a little fudge.
Yeah. Well, you know, the
shiny happy numbers.
They're claiming 20 watts off the LP2020A. And you're probably getting like a usable 6 or 8 watts max. And pretty much everybody who's played around with them is basically like throw away the power supply that came in the box and buy a high quality 12-volt 5-amp power supply because they don't get enough power as they come from the factory. And there's been a lot of people who've experimented with them with capacitor upgrades and stuff. But you know, I was shocked. I had built a suitcase boombox, and I used a pretty nice set of JL Audio speakers that I had separates that were supposed to go in a truck that went away. And, you know, one of the Lapi amplifiers, and one, they draw no power. Like, it's amazing how long a battery will last for those. And two, they sound shockingly good. I'd like a little more reinforcement in the low end, but I think the power supply upgrade helps with that. But that theme with Class T amplifiers, you got to look out, because the other one that Brian mentions is Dayton Audio's DTA 120. And I think, if memory serves, it's like 60 watts per channel rated, except that's 60 watts into 4 ohms, 40 watts into 8 ohm speakers, and that's at 10% distortion. So, you know, 10% distortion, I assure you, is unusable. So the real world power on these is considerably lower than what it's rated. You know, out of those, the Topping has a pretty good reputation.
I bought this relatively inexpensive pile T-Class amp, and that I used for driving. I think it was about less than $30.
That's the same thing as the Lapi.
And I ended up driving like 6 speakers just temporarily. It was a crazy wiring situation, but we had blown an amp and we were waiting for a replacement. And in the meantime, I had one of these around, and I was fairly shocked at how well it worked.
Yeah.
For its size and the number of things we were driving, couldn't be happier. And
yeah.
Compact, lightweight, low power.
If it doesn't arrive dead on arrival, it's probably going to last a long time. So, you know, I guess this is a long way of saying is I'd probably go with one of the Lapi amps and just get a decent power supply for it, spend $25. You know, because by the time you're getting into $100 or $200, you know, you could build a gain clone amp for less than that. Dayton Audio's APA 100, which is a Class AB amplifier with a very nice power section inside of it. That's going to give you, that's you know, most of the audiophile amplifiers, audiophile amps, are Class AB amplifiers. And, you know, most of the it's just, it's good stuff. You know, that would probably be my pick. That's not as small as Brian wants. So Brian, I'm going to say, just spend $25 on a Lepi, get a better power supply for it, and see if that satisfies your needs. And if not, return it to Amazon and go with the Dayton, DTA 120, or consider one of the Topping amplifiers. But I feel like those cheap amplifiers, I feel like there's more in common between the $25 amplifier and the $120 Class T amplifier. Then there is different, and I'd rather go with a, you know, Class AB amp if you have the space for it.
Cool.
So
Dayton Audio is one of those websites and one of the few magazines I still receive for their sales stuff, because I occasionally buy stuff from them. But they also have just speaker enclosures, and you can
Oh, you're thinking Parts Express.
Oh, no, you're right. I'm sorry. But
DaytonAudio.com is a website.
Yeah, but I'm thinking of Parts Express sells a bunch of Dayton stuff.
Yeah. Well, Dayton Audio is
there
like,
might be some relationship between those two companies, but yeah, you're right.
One probably owns the other one, but, you know, there's...
It's like whenever I was buying Dayton Audio stuff, I was going to Parts Express to get it. Anyway.
Well, you know, it's good that you mentioned that, because you can find a lot of the Parts Express or Dayton Audio stuff on Amazon.com.
Okay,
but you
cool.
are usually paying... a premium for the Amazon availability on that.
Similar to sometimes how you deal with monoprice gear, too.
And now I'm on Parts Express looking at speaker kits, because apparently I need another set of speakers in my living room.
Yes. Build them yourself.
I'm going to be
selecting your drivers,
your
selecting your enclosures. Baffling. Baffling indeed.
Oh, my goodness. You had some follow-up. We were talking about... we had a... last episode about aging AVRs and how to deal with new HDMI gear. Basically, the viewer had, you know, he's trying to upgrade his AVRs as little as possible.
Oh, exactly.
Which seems perfectly reasonable. In his pre-HDMI days, he just needed to upgrade his amplifiers once a millennia, and now it seems like every 15 minutes there's a new HDMI spec.
Yeah, this person...
I'm exaggerating.
This person had bought the newer HDMI-enabled AVR for switching, but now that the 4K stuff's coming... and they didn't buy this amp that long ago. We got to talking about that Samsung UHD BD player and the UBD K8500. And one thing I might not have pointed out is that it does 4K apps too. It's one of the few set-top boxes you're going to find that not only does the disc playback in 4K, but also all the apps like Amazon, Netflix, and so on, YouTube, with 4K support as well. So that's a great item to like slip into existing gear to make it all work for the time being until a few years from now or whenever you're down the road and looking at doing that 4K UHD AVR upgrade. This could be the temporary Band-Aid. Granted, you're running separate HDMI cables for the video going to the TV and to the AVR for audio, and that may necessitate the use of another port on the TV if you're just trying to, you know, get it down to one cable. But at least this box gives you those options.
Yeah.
And when it came into HDMI, as far as ports go and compatibility with the devices out there, one observation I've had is that the companies that do HDMI testing internally, and they incorporate this into product development, generally will give the end user less pain and hassle in terms of connecting other devices to it.
Right.
For HDMI, there's a company called SimPlay Labs. They've been around for a long time and through various iterations. And every TV I've ever touched that had the SimPlay Labs testing stamped on it seemed to have fewer or no recalling enabled issues, so to speak. Device compatibility, the port switching speed, the prompt and proper HDCP setup as far as handshaking and everything else goes, everything just seems to work on those TVs. So I'll make it a point for any future stuff I'm looking at is to see what kind of HDMI testing they're incorporating into their products, because that's one small thing. Yeah, it does cost money initially up front for a manufacturer, you know, put a product through testing. But man, when it comes to HDMI is the port that we use for connecting all of these things. And anything that's to help make that less of a hassle for the end user is win-win for me. So I just a thank to the SimPlay Labs folks, and may more manufacturers incorporate that testing into their products. SimPlay used to require that you had to send products to them for evaluation and testing. Nowadays, actually, they create a bunch of field usable devices that manufacturers can buy where you plug in the source into one side, plug in the output on the other side, and make sure all of the things like HDCP 2.2 support, various formats, the handshaking, all of that can be tested in a very automated fashion nowadays. So I am just seeing now, it used to be that you could look in a manual for a TV and see the SimPlay Lab stamp in there in terms of all the other, you know, certifications they have. It would be nice, you know, I mean, we have this Ultra HD format for describing the performance of the TVs, but it would be nice to say, hey, we've also taken a look at all the HDMI, the inputs on the TV, to make sure that everything you're going to be connecting, or an AVR for this matter, everything you're going to be connecting will work. It won't be the problem in your chain of devices. And that would go a long way toward just making life good for all home theater aficionados, so to speak. And that's the one thing. I just wanted to give a quick shout out to the SimPlay Labs folks. I noticed their work, and I appreciate it. And I'm really glad they've got these field testing devices, and I really hope more companies, especially these AVR folks, start incorporating that testing. Because if that is truly going to be the hub of all things in the home theater, which an AVR is exceptional at doing it, but when it doesn't work, it is such a pain in the butt. You really, it can be such an expensive outlay of cash for that one device. You can really feel burned, and let's avoid that. No burning.
It's always good to not feel burned.
And then I was also talking about hybrid log gamma, basically a very cool sounding term. In production for HDR video, there's a couple. We have HDR10, we have Dolby Vision, we have a few of these standards for describing the brightness within scenes. But for doing live video production, all of the systems that require metadata in the video stream can be problematic. And we were talking a little bit about this.
Right.
And we were talking about hybrid log gamma, which is a system developed by NHK and BBC for addressing this very issue. And effectively, the signal has no internal metadata, but, and I'll quote right off the BBC article on their own site for about high dynamic range, the signal represents relative light levels in the original scene. We're talking hybrid log gamma encoded video. And this allows the picture from a single mastering process or a live production to be adapted to given the same artistic effect on brighter or darker screens in the home. Only the display itself needs information about its own capabilities and environment to faithfully render the scene reference signal. So metadata that describes the mastering display is not required. HLG also has native compatibility with standard dynamic range SDR TVs within the same color gamut, the same color format, which can also be used for ultra-high definition UHD SDR displays. So what that's really saying is, in a sense, it's very similar to the standards we've been using all along for Gamma, where it is the scene actually is the brightness of that specific scene determines how it will be rendered, whether in standard dynamic range or high dynamic range.
That has me thinking about that Marvel color thing. But we're not going to talk about that till next week.
That is a whole different
ball of weasels.
Anyway, just to clarify on how HGL works, or hybrid log gamma, HLG. Yeah, make sure I say that right. It is actually representing within the signal itself that dynamic range, be it for use on regular televisions or high dynamic range TVs, and having that single signal, you know, in a metadata-free environment makes it very easy for production, or, you know, in a live broadcast environment where you could have mixed signals, overlays, graphics being added, something that you wouldn't encounter in content that we receive. Movies, say, from Netflix, or discs like UHD Blu-ray, where it's fixed on that disc. It isn't going to be altered beyond that point. But in live production environments where things can change at the moment, from moment to moment, yeah, something like hybrid log gamma was necessary. And it's good to see more and more displays. We'll be adding that. I'm just hoping the big question will be, will all these 2016 4K UHD TVs provide some upgrade path for that, for support? Some will. Not all. But not again... How much content are we actually going to be looking at?
We were talking on Shannon and I were talking about some of our ATTV picks. We did a big Black Friday episode of Tech Thing this week because Black Friday, shopping mayhem. The thing we talked about the TCL 4K TV that's selling 55 inches, selling for $400. And the thing I forgot to mention is that it's not HDR.
Yes.
And then part of me was like, at $400. Who cares? There's not that much HDR content out there anyway. So, you know, if you're spending $1,500, get one with HDR. If you're spending $400, don't feel so bad.
Yeah, don't expect 1,000 nits out of a $400 TV. So, right. Period.
That seems particularly reasonable. It seems reasonable to not expect 1,000 nits out of a $400
TV. Don't expect the world from value. So that's why I really tell people when they're shopping for a new TV, it's like, just cut to the chase. Is it the biggest screen at the best price, or is it you want the wow factor? And the wow factor costs a little more. So,
or a lot more.
Or a lot more, yes.
If you want the OLED, the wow factor this year.
I want that Sony high-end projector, that 4K man. Beauty of theirs.
Just sell a kidney.
With hybrid log gamma support. Among other things.
Dork. Blu-ray streaming picks this week. Netflix is, I think I mentioned this last week, Netflix is the queen, is really good, especially if you missed Downton Abbey. Huh. To Live and Die in L.A. has come out on Blu-ray.
Holy cow, the original?
The original, 1985, Willem Dafoe.
The movie that was teaching all of us how to counterfeit money?
Yes. Yes, it was.
And it almost got banned by the Secret Service.
Yes.
Back in the day.
That movie.
Jeez.
You know, yeah. I love watching Willem Dafoe act, and he looks like he's 12 in this film so long ago. Kubo and the Two Strings is out on Blu-ray. I'm going to pick that up for movie night with the boys this weekend. That looks to be an utterly stunning film. And if you're not into animation, or animation with heavy Japanese, you know, two-string guitar mayhem battle awesomeness, this is probably not going to appeal to you at all, but it's going to look gorgeous from everything I've heard. One of the movies I will never entirely understand why it is out on Blu-ray, except that it is certainly an example of a time and place we will never see again. The Criterion Collection did One-Eyed Jacks on Blu-ray. Marlon Brando. Marlon Brando, Carl Malden. I may be confusing it with another Marlon Brando flick. It's Criterion. It's an excellent transfer. If you're a fan of Brando, it's definitely one to check out. The Squid and the Whale is out on another Criterion collection edition. I seem to remember weeping in this movie, but I may be confusing it with another movie that came out in 2005. But that's about two young boys dealing with their parents' divorce in Brooklyn in the 1980s. Which is the kind of thing that really hypes you up for a feel-good experience. Aw. Well, you know. It's some fantastic acting, though. Like, I think Roger Ebert gave it like 3.5 stars. You know, the well, there it is. Roger Ebert, I don't know what I'm supposed to be feeling during The Squid and the Whale. Sympathy, I suppose, for two bright boys whose parents are getting a messy divorce. Both parents are writers and use words as weapons. The boys choose sides and join the war. In theory, I observe their errors and sadness and think, there before the grace of God go I. In practice, I feel envy. Fascinating film. So, and yeah, if you're a fan of weird 70s stuff, Chud is out on Blu-ray.
Hey, man. 80s.
Was Chud 80s? I thought Chud was like 73.
What the heck did Chud's... Oh, Cannibalistic Humanoid Underground Dweller.
Yeah.
I always love that. Chud.
Before there was... it was 1984. Gosh, I thought that was like 10 years older than that.
Slasher cult film.
Yeah, bizarre murders in New York City seem to point to a group of grotesquely deformed vagrants living in the sewers, writes Blu-ray.com.
I'd throw that one up there with... what is it? Yeah. Reanimator. There's a good Blu-ray. Definitely adults. Adult only. But there is some... The Blu-ray has some... memorable scenes in it.
Yeah. Not the best transfer, but
I'm not looking at that for video quality. It's more for what am I looking at?
What was I thinking when I rented this?
So funny.
Man. With that, ladies and gentlemen, so many more things we could talk about. We're going to save those for next week. Remember, we got our patron-only hangout. If you want to be involved in that, check out patreon.com/AVXL, and we're going to send you out an email on Saturday with a link to the Google Hangouts, and that is Saturday the 26th. We'll be planning our next couple in December. If you are curious what's happening at CES, we will be there in force. And hey, thanks for listening. Go to avxl.com for the links on how to subscribe or search your favorite podcaster. And you can tweet at Robert Heron, at Patrick Norton, or at avxl, or go to facebook.com/avxl.
Man, we would love to hear from you.
We would.
We look at everything.
We do.
Every bit of correspondence, we appreciate.
Once your sleep has been removed, there's just an infinite number of hours in the day.
Oh, man. I am going to go take a look at what my local Dolby Cinema Theater is showing.
Ooh.
I have yet to actually walk into this theater. I've been waiting for them to show something I want to see. Oh. So far it's been like, nah, not interested. But
I hope Arrival's there.
I got to get that 4K laser in my face.
I want to see Arrival so badly.
And that superb audio and the color
and the
everything.
Color.
It's what got me to go back to the movies again. So, and if I can have a reserved seat with a cup holder.
It just gets better.
And transducers vibrating my nether regions. It added to the experience, and I
never quite heard a butt thumper referred to as that way. But
I'm trying not to use the trademark names.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Butt thumper. I don't think that's it either. Is it?
No, it's not.
No, it's got something even better.
I thought it was butt shaker.
Yeah, I think you're right. Butt kicker.
Butt kicker.
Buttkicker.com. Nah, don't do that. No, maybe.
Well, you know,
safe search on. No.
Anybody ever made a DIY butt kicker?
Butt kicker.
Apparently there is a butt kicker and a butt shaker. Really?
There is a song called Rump Shaker.
In case you're wondering what we're talking about, essentially this is the transducer, the magnet, the motor. Think of a very large motor from a subwoofer, but with no cone. So it vibrates your chair so you can feel.
And it's kind of nice in the sense of it's different from a sub. Where a sub is projecting that sound through air, this is like literally putting it through the thing you're touching, or usually a seat that you're sitting in. So,
well, you know, unless you're talking about really big orchestral music involving like magnificent, you know, organs, there's not a lot of audio below 40 hertz, right? So,
and I don't think you need a butt kicker system for, you know, classical art and things like that for listening.
Yeah, but I don't need a butt kicker for Coltrane, but for explosions.
Yeah.
If you like feeling an explosion, because you stop, you know, there's audio below 20 hertz, you just can't hear it, but you can still feel it. And if you've ever been near something blowing up, and a shout out to everybody who served in all sorts of scary places in the last 50 years. If you've ever been near a large explosion, I have, not in the service, you feel it deep in your body. And that's the whole point of one of the transducers you mount to your furniture to shake it when the mayhem hits.
Indubitably. Indubitably.
You know, we were going to end this show, and then we
just
kept going.
And I just had to ramble.
AVXL.com, patreon.com/AVXL, Robert Herron, and Patrick Norton.
Do it, people.
Thank you so much. See you next week.